Heavenly Father, today we put on the full armor to protect us against attack. We put on the belt of truth to protect against lies and deception. We put on the breastplate of righteousness to protect our hearts from the temptations. We put the gospel of peace on our feet to walk in your light, peace, and freedom with the Holy Spirit. We rebuke anxious thoughts. We take up your shield of faith for protection to block and destroy all the darts and threats thrown at us by the enemy. We put on the helmet of salvation to cover our minds and thoughts, reminding us that we are children of a mighty King. We are forgiven, set free, saved by the blood of Jesus. We take up the sword of the Spirit, your living word, that has the power to demolish strongholds and is sharper than any double-edged sword. We come to you, Lord, in prayer daily. In Jesus' mighty name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
What's up, you guys? Welcome to The Imagination. I'm your host, Emma, and today I'm honored to have back on the show for part two of her testimony feature, Human Trafficking, Satanic Ritual Abuse, and Jesuit Mind Control, Survivor and Whistleblower, writer and author, mother, educator, blogger, and one of my most requested podcast guests, Svali. A short overview of Svali's life, in case you're new here. Svali has been a voice for survivors for years now through her blogs, Svali Speaks and Svali Speaks Again, and the book she has authored, Breaking Free of Cult Programming and It's Not Impossible, which have laid the foundations for what we know today about cults, trauma-based mind control, deprogramming, secret societies, including the Jesuit Order, the history of the Illuminati, and so much more. Born and raised in a cult group and having experienced horrors beyond comprehension, Svali broke free of her cult group several years ago and has been on a quest to share the knowledge that she has learned from personal experience to help set other captives free. There are years of eye-opening information on her blogs and her books give a very concise and no-nonsense look at the underworld of mind control and the underlying mechanisms to which it is orchestrated, used generationally, and hidden from society. Svali's first two episodes on the podcast were phenomenal and educational deep dives into the world of programming and mind control, secret societies, emotions, and healing. And the last time Svali was on, we did a part one of her own personal and inspiring testimony, starting from childbirth into her adult years. If you missed any of these episodes, I'll have her playlist in the show notes for you guys to check out. And I highly recommend you listen to part one of her testimony either before or after this episode to hear her story in its entirety. On today's episode, we're picking up where we left off from part one and venturing into Svali's journey, leaving her cult group, the struggle she faced in staying free, her journey through healing, and her walk with God along the way. Svali's piece of the puzzle in both her personal testimony and the information she's been compiling and sharing on both her blog and in her books over the years cannot be understated. She has been referenced on this podcast alone by multiple guests and survivors who found healing, hope, and understanding in her work. And I've personally benefited greatly from Svali's work, which has helped me tremendously in accelerating my own understandings as to what the guests on my show have gone through and what children today are still going through. Svali is a ray of light being cast on the darkness, and although she doesn't sugarcoat the reality of mind control and abuse, her focus and emphasis has always been on healing, both in helping survivors navigate their healing journey and in educating helpers of survivors, such as therapists, on how to best assist a survivor in their healing journey. Svali took the things that were meant to break her and turn them into ways to set herself and other captives free. She's helped pioneer the path to healing and hope for so many, and her work will undoubtedly be studied and referenced for generations to come as more and more survivors leave their own cults and set out on the journey to freedom from mind control. Svali's perpetrators depended on her silence, but God always had other plans for her. God knew that one day Svali would speak, and that her voice would be one that would shake and help burn down the walls of the Luciferian kingdom. And boy, was he right. We are also blessed to learn from Svali, and I ask that you please give her your full attention and take notes as you listen to this incredible part two of her redemptive and inspiring testimony. Before I finish introducing today's guest, I wanted to give just a couple quick reminders and updates. If you'd like to be a guest on the podcast or share any information privately with me, please email me at imagineabetterworld2020@gmail.com. You can also use this email if you'd like to be a part of and contribute to my new book series, featuring written testimonies by survivors and whistleblowers. And you can find the video outlining all the details of that project in the show notes. And lastly, I'd love your support on my Substack, where I'm taking up investigative journalism, and you can subscribe to me there at www.emmacatherine.substack.com. All of my links are in the show notes, and I can't thank you all enough for caring so deeply about each amazing guest and for helping to make the imagination the safest place on the internet for survivor disclosures. So you guys, without further ado, please help me in welcoming today's guest of honor, voice for the voiceless, woman of God, overcomer, walking miracle, and someone who continues to help so many break free from cult programming by showing them exactly what's possible, the one, the only, Spolly. Spolly, thank you so much for being here with me today.
Well, Emma, thank you for having me. And I think every survivor that gets out is a miracle. I think I'm one among many, many, many. So who are brave, courageous, and I think others have just as much or more courage than I do. And I appreciate your courage in having this podcast too and sharing this information with the world. So thank you.
Thank you too. It's a two-way street, you know. We need helpers and we need people willing to educate the helpers and to, you know, it's a team effort doing this. I always say it takes a village to raise a child and it's going to take the whole world to save a child. So we're all in this together and, you know, your work has helped me tremendously throughout the years. I'm certainly not the only one. And I couldn't agree more. All survivors are walking miracles. They're all heroes. And they're a true testament of how you can take the most horrible things and turn them into the brightest lights, you know, and you've helped really pave the way for people with your journey and with all the information that you've put out. You know, it's not to be understated how you've helped other people get to where you are in a sense, you know, or at least helped inspire them to want to get there. So I appreciate you putting yourself out there and, you know, having the courage that you have to talk about this really hard stuff, including today on this show. So I know last time we started sharing your testimony, we went through some of your childhood. We talked about your teenage years and worked into your adult years. And I know these stories sort of skip around a little bit, but I wanted to turn it over to you to start wherever you wanted to today for part two. And we'll get more into the adult years and the healing journey, the amazing healing journey that you've went through with God by your side, and to talk more about the miracles that you've experienced in your life.
Okay. Well, I think last time I ended with coming back from California to stay with my friend in Texas. And I'm sharing some of my struggles, but I also want to share about some of the miracles that God did too. So it's both. Because I so empathize with the struggle survivors have when getting out. And that's one reason I'm sharing my story, so that, you know, this was not a cakewalk, but God has been faithful as well. And when I came back from California, my friend said I could stay with her for 2 weeks, my friend in Texas. And during that time, I searched desperately for a place to stay. I contacted every therapist I'd ever worked with, well-known therapists around the nation. I said, do you know of a safe house? Do you know of anywhere that I can go? And I heard, no, 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 sorry, no. Or I heard back, well, you could live with this person I know who's a survivor. But I didn't feel comfortable with that because I knew that from myself early on in healing, until I knew all my parts, it was possible that I could have a job to access them, or vice versa, their job could be to access me. And so I did not want to live with another survivor at that time. I just didn't feel comfortable with it. And so finally, I contacted and ended up going to Teen Challenge in a large city in Southern Texas. And while I was there, they had the expectation after the first 3 days that you work for at least 4 to 5 hours a day. They had a factory there and I tried working at the factory. And it was okay. It was boring. But then they had kitchen work. And I thought, well, that might be better. Cause you know, I thought, well, I'll help out in the kitchen. So I asked and they said, yeah, you can go in the kitchen. Because I had a lot, suddenly I had recontact programming firing like crazy at that time, to the point where I was miserable. At night, I could not sleep. I would sleep 1 or 2 hours a night because just the punishment I was going through inside because I wasn't recontacting the group, the order that I was leaving. And they had, you know, as I was, you know, out and about because the Teen Challenge, we'd go to churches and sing or we would do this or that. So after a few weeks, you know, I saw some people in those churches signing to me too. And that made it even worse. So I was doing my best to try to work in the kitchen, you know, for 4 hours a day. And they had a very structured thing where you go to chapel, you do your job, and then you come back and then you do Bible study. And, you know, it was a very, because very structured, but it was hard because I went to the staff and I said, I'm having trouble sleeping and that you're not allowed any sleeping medication or that you weren't then. This was years ago. And so I said, well, what do? I can't sleep. And I was told, well, eventually you'll collapse and be able to sleep. I'm like, oh, this is just wonderful. Well, finally, after I'd been there about a month, I had not slept in 2 nights in a row and I couldn't get up to go to work. And I told the each room had like a room leader. And so I told her what it was going on. And she knew about my cult stuff because over the month I'd started telling some of the girls what I was dealing with and that I had a lot of programming running. So later she said, you're being called into the office, go there now. So I went into the office and the director of that Teen Challenge was there. And he looked at me, he said, I understand you're telling the girls that you came out of a cult group and you have programming running and that you can't sleep because you have dissociative parts that are punishing you. I said, yes. And he said, that is the biggest bunch of hogwash I've ever heard in my life. You're a liar. Unless you sit here and tell me that you're lying about being dissociative in the cult, I'm going to kick you out immediately. He looks at me. I look at him. I said, I'm not a liar. And I'm telling them the truth. And he said, then get your bags and go. So he then called my friend that I'd stayed with before in Texas. And he called her. I found this out later from my friend. And he said, your friend didn't want to obey the rules here. So she told me she wanted to leave. So she left. Don't let her come back with you. So I'm out on the street and I have no money because I brought money with me, but it was all there in the safe. They didn't give me any of my money. So I have nothing. I don't have a cell phone. I actually borrowed a cell phone to call my friend in Texas that I stayed with before I went to Teen Challenge. And she goes, I can't help you. Bye. Click. And I'm like, this is horrible. And I wondered what had happened to her. But then, so I'm wandering the streets with a backpack and I meet this, homeless guy on the streets. He was a man of color. And he said, you look like you're having a hard time. I said, yeah, I have nowhere to go. He said, well, you can sleep with me under the bridge tonight. And I'm thinking, I guess if I have to, I will. But I'm thinking, dear God, help me, please. I don't want to sleep under a bridge. And he took me to a food line. So I got a bologna sandwich at lunch. And finally I said to him, do you know any women's shelters around here or anything? And he said, no, but I know of a place you can go where you can find out. So he took me to a large social service agency and I really appreciate, I mean, he was a nice guy, you know, I mean, he was kind of seemed mentally off to me, but he wasn't vicious or cruel and he didn't hurt me or anything. He was actually really nice and really helpful. He was showing me like where all the places you could go if you're homeless in this large city was. So I will always be thankful that God let me know him. And I went to the agency and I told them I don't have anywhere to live. I've been kicked out. And finally, they said, well, there's a women's shelter. And it was about 20 minutes away. And I said, well, I have no car. I have no cell phone. And they said, it's okay. We'll get you a token on the bus there and you can go there. So I got on the bus and I went to the small city about 25 minutes away. And went to the women's shelter, was admitted. And so I had a place to stay. And after I'd been there I got to know the girls. A lot of the girls there actually were leaving relationships where they were with boyfriends who were drug addicts. A lot of the gals were still doing drugs there, but just not telling the staff. I didn't. And of course it wasn't my job to squeal on anyone. And some of them were, dealing drugs, you know, and again, that wasn't my business. I was just there. I went to a safe place. But after a few weeks, you know, I got to know some of the girls, made some friends with them. And then I went back to my friend in Texas's house to go get my car because I left at her house because I realized if I was going to get a job, I wanted a car because I tried the buses to get. I was working at a restaurant and it was hard to as a waitress. Here I am, 51 years old, working as a waitress for the first time in my life. But I got enough money together to get a bus ticket to my friends. And then I went and got my car, came back down. And then I started working at as a waitress at a Luby's there. And I was making okay tips. I mean, I was making $80 to $90 a night, you know, at that point, which was enough for me to save up. And then one of the gals and I got an apartment and then I've been, but, or no, actually after 3 months, you know, the director of the women's home changed. While I was there, they got a new director and she came around to all of us and they said, you're only allowed to stay here 2 weeks and you have to leave. So another gal and I got a place to live together. We actually got a small house and rented it. And then I was still working as a waitress. But by then I'd gone to, it was a really high class restaurant in town that's known around the nation. And we wore tuxedos and it was, you know, and then I started getting like $150 tips each night, you know. So even though I was older, you know, because I'm pretty active and fairly strong, I was able to learn to hold those trays. You have to hold them like waitresses do and stuff, you know, and there were waiters too. And I became friends with the people there. I was there for about a month. And then my friend from Texas came down. She saw I was working. She said, oh man, you're doing really great. You know, this is awesome. I said, yeah, it's hard work, but you know, I'm doing my best. But I did tell her that, you know, there were people at the women's shelter that tried to contact me that came down to visit, quote unquote, their friends at the shelter and tried to. And one of them had a friend of a friend who wanted to talk with me. And I'm thinking, why, you know, and she and obviously it was someone from the group and she was saying, come back or else, you know, and I didn't. But I did have some panic still running inside because of my recontact programming. And the way I dealt it, though, is I went to a doctor and got a prescription for anti-anxiety medication so that when the, and another one for pain so that when they ran too much, and I felt like I was being tortured inside that at least I could calm down and sleep. And I tried not to take it every night, but just when I needed it. And so I've been in the small city now for about 3-4 months. And then one night I'm there, and one of my ex-husband's closest friends was there, my second husband. He shows up with a party of people. And one of the other waitresses comes and she says, I have a really bad feeling about that party over there because he's asking for you, but not by the name you've given us. Because I was working under an assumed name. You know, I'd given them a fake name at the restaurant. And he's asking for you, but it's not the name I know you by. And so she said, what do you want me to tell him? Well, he saw me. I saw him. I said, I might as well go over there and talk. So I went over and he goes, oh, what are you doing here in town? We've been looking for you. And I'm like, yeah, well, it's just been so long, blah, blah, blah. And I just said, well, I needed some time away, you know, and blah, blah, blah. You know, I told him some no nonsense. You know, I said, blah, blah, blah. So he's making obvious he knows me and his friends are sitting around and I know them and they know me and they're all from the group. And I go, all right. And so I said, I got to get back to work. So I kind of brush him off. And after work that night, after they've, you know, all the customers are gone, we cleaned up. I went to my boss and I said, I've got to leave town. I said, you know, and my boss was nice. He says, you can't keep running forever. All he knew is I had an abusive ex. I didn't tell them about the cult stuff. I said, well, but I can't stay here now. They, you know, my ex will know where I am. You know, they'll know where I am. And he said, I stay. And I said, I can't. So he gave me my final paycheck. The next morning, I got in my car. And I'm driving, I've been driving about 20 minutes and my car starts to overheat. Like it goes into the red zone. So I have to stop, steam's coming out. I have to wait for it to cool down and then I add water. I get to a service station and it happens again. So I'm praying the whole time because I called my friend and she said I could come up and stay with her for a couple of days because I told her what had happened. And so I literally And I had a burner phone to call because I realized at that point that I didn't dare have a cell phone and that I would probably be tracked. So about every half hour, I had to stop this car because it's overheating so bad, add more water because the radiator was boiling dry. And I'm praying the whole time, God, help me to make it up to my friends, please. I mean, she was about 4 hours away. Finally, I make it to her house. It's like 2 a.m., you know, and then I kind of collapse and fall asleep. And the next two days later, she has another friend that's staying there. And he looks my car over because he used to do a lot of mechanical work. And he said, you should not have been able to drive this car up here. I said, why? He says, let me show you something. He had gone through the radiator and flushed it and started taking it apart. And he said, somebody wadded up a small ball, tiny ball of aluminum foil. And that's why it was overheating. He said, there's no way you made it up here. I said, I did. I said, I prayed. I put my hand on the car and pray. And you know, and that's how I got here. So I stayed with my friend for another 2 weeks. And then I entered another teen challenge in a city closer by. And because there was nowhere to stay. And my friend at that point said, well, you can't stay here, you know, so you've got to find your own place. And so I didn't know what else to do. And that was a really, really nice teen challenge, very different from the first one. You didn't have to work. You didn't have to do all that stuff. Lots of Bible study and lots of, you know, and just much nicer place. And they were wonderful there. And I can't speak highly enough about them. I was there for a few months, for 2 months. But then after I've been there about a month, they suddenly had one of their former Teen Challenge gals who had, I guess, had graduated like 8 years before and who is now a Christian counselor at a church in another city show up and say, and they said, you can come for your sabbatical. She'd asked if she could come and just spend time there for her sabbatical out of the blue. And so I'd been there about maybe a month or 5 weeks. And she starts coming up to me and talking to me. And she starts saying, well, I'm a cult survivor too. And can you look at my journal and the pictures in there? And she just wants to talk. And she's showing me her system maps and diagrams, but they're really triggering. And I don't feel comfortable doing this. But then she has friends that start visiting her and they all want to talk to me too. And so, and they were basically telling me about all the people, loved ones that were being tortured because I was there and saying, come back or else they'll all die. So after about 3 weeks of this, I had a mini nervous breakdown in the dining room where I just said, I can't take it anymore. And I'm shaking, I'm crying. And they call my friend. They said, you need to come get her because she's having a difficult time. So my friend came and got me and she said, you can stay here. And you can work on healing, she said, you know, but I expect you to journal at least 8 hours a day while you're here. That's one of my requirements. I need to know you're working on healing. I said, fine. So I took my burner phone. And I put it on a truck going to another part of the state in case they were tracking it. I had no phone, no internet. And my friend let me stay with her for 2 years. And for 2 years, except for on Sundays, I journaled basically 8 hours a day. And that's when my memories started really pouring out. I got in my cover memories of the Illuminati before, but this is, and I am so grateful that she allowed me that time. It was a very lonely time because, you know, I was allowed to go to church. I was allowed to go to the store and that was it. You know, otherwise I stayed in the house and I journaled this full 2 years. And it was hard. But I did, and I started parts in my journals. I started meeting parts. They were drawing pictures of themselves, what they did. Parts were talking to me. I created an internal healing team. I found out who my major controllers were. That's when I discovered that I was Jesuit because I was seeing the 12 Illuminati fathers inside, but behind each one, I saw a Jesuit father. I thought, what the heck is this? And then I asked the parts, who are you? And they said, we're the 12 fathers, the Jesuit fathers. We're over the Illuminati fathers. I'm like, you are? And they're like, yeah. And I said, well, why are you in my head? And they said, because you serve us. And I'm like, what do you mean? And that's when the memories of Rome start pouring out one after another. I mean, it was just nonstop. I probably filled about 20 journals while I was there. And then I would do a little processing with my friend. I mean, she was not a therapist. She was not a prayer minister, but I come to her and say, this is what I remembered yesterday, you know? And so she prayed with me a little bit and say, God, just help her as she's working through this. Or she would talk with me because I'd come in just crying, just devastated by memories because emotions were pouring out too. I mean, I had littles crying because they've been so hurt by these people. I had other littles crying because they missed these people. But the one thing that was really difficult for me though, during that time is I missed my ex-husband. I missed people. And I spent 6 weeks just crying for them. Every day I cried for hours and hours and hours. My grief was so great. And then she had another fully integrated survivor there would come to me and they'd say like, well, why are you crying for them? They're abusers. They're the cult. Why would you, you know, there's something ungodly about missing people who were your abusers. And I said, but I love them too. And I can't stop the grief. What I didn't know is I wasn't just grieving for my ex-husband or a couple of people. I was grieving for my mothers in all the presentation countries, my children, my husbands, and the people I loved that I'd grown up with in the facility. I was grieving in a whole lifetime of relationships. I wasn't aware of that consciously at the time. All I knew is the grief was just pouring out. And so, but for the first time in my life, I wasn't on the run and I wasn't being hurt. And that was new. And so parts are telling me what they did. I was meeting in my internal secret Vatican council, which is not the one in the public. You know, I was meeting my mage councils inside. I was starting to get to know different spiritual parts. It just all, I was meeting my internal controllers and did tons and tons and tons. And that's why I wasn't online at all during that time. That's why I think there's rumors going around like, well, Solly got killed or this or that, which was not true. I did not go online whatsoever because I knew the minute I went online that I would be seeing subliminals and things that would try to slow down my healing or be seeing videos running in the background of someone I love being tortured and that would slow my healing down. And I still do not go online very much. Like even as I'm talking right now, my screen is covered so I can't see anything running in the background. And I don't think a lot of people understand technology is good, but it has its bad parts too. And anytime you're looking at a smartphone or your computer or you're watching your TV, because TVs now are online, you're connected online and you're seeing subliminals. And those subliminals can be pretty rough. And so that's why I tend to have a non-dissociative friend with near me when I'm online so that I won't see those things. And it helps a lot. Anyway, so, but I wasn't online at all, no cell phone, nothing. And so I did this intense work and that's how I remembered a lot of this stuff. But after a couple of years, the person who was the healed survivor who was staying and he basically did like handiwork for my friend and things like that came to me and he said, I'm in love with you. And I'm like, what? And I said, I thought you were in love with my friend, you know, I mean, it was nothing sexual between them and nothing sexual with me. He's like, no, I'm in love with you. And then I told my friend, I cannot do this to my other friend. I think she loves you and I couldn't hurt or betray her. And he goes, she doesn't love me. There's no love there. And then he shared with me how he, all the hard work he'd been doing for years. And all he got was a new pair of overalls once a year. And $20. And I'm like, you're almost a slave, an unpaid slave here. How can you live this way? And I only had his side. So it's possible that she was much more generous. But I never saw him with money. So I can tell you, and I know he worked constantly in the yard and doing things and fixing things. So I don't know the truth of that. But what I did say, as I said, if you want to leave, you can come with me because I'm getting tired of living here too. And I won't go into the things. I had a big argument with my friend about some other things, not just how she treated this person, but some other things I saw that were very dysfunctional. She was not cult. She was not dissociative, but she had some issues. And I'd been there for 2 years and I just had it. And I said, I need to leave. You know, I need to make my own way now for a while. So my friend came with me, the one that was in love with me, and we went up to Arkansas and bought some land. And my first friend, I think, never forgave me because she always thought I had led her friend who helped her out around the house away from her. And I'm so sorry now for some of the ugly things I said to her at the time. And I had my own part to play in it too. I realize now, and that's that I wasn't fully healed. I was still working on my stuff and I had issues. And so I also said some things I should never have said during the big blow up, if you know what I mean. But so I went with my friend, I bought some land in Arkansas because I did have some money saved up over the years from work and from, I had also gotten a small inheritance when my mother in America died. And so for a few thousand dollars, I got some land. And at that time, I tried to create a fake ID. I did not know it's illegal and a felony to do so because my survivor friend who had integrated was from a different group than mine. And he said, it's okay to do that. You know, I've had friends that do that. So I made a fake driver's license because I went to live under assumed identity. I did not want to go through witness protection because I personally believe organizations like that are infiltrated. So I might as well have given them my new address and where I was living to them, and they would have contacted the cult. And that's my own personal belief. So I created a fake ID at this person's suggestion. And then I tried to use it to create a bank account for myself under my new name. I was going to put my own money in it, you know, from under my legal name. And what happened is, as I showed the ID to the gal, she's, you know, she said, well, let me go ahead and set up the account. But what she didn't say is she brought the police. They arrested me and I was in jail that night with a felony now on my record. And I said, I didn't know I was committing a felony. It's my own money. I'm not committing a crime. They said, just doing this is a crime. And they said, you're either stupid as crap or, and I probably was. So.
But I also just want to say too, you know, the way that you grew up, these were things for people listening that when you're in these systems, you don't really have to worry about. Like you're not doing taxes every year. Like you're given fake IDs and fake identities. Like your whole life is sort of a facade in a way, you know? And so for people that are like, how couldn't she have known that? That is so common. I've heard for survivors who are like, I didn't even know like how to do taxes whenever I left. Like I didn't know about, you know, this and that, like all these like real world responsibilities, like you don't have to worry about that or even like getting arrested, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, but my presentation didn't know this, but I'm pretty sure my back parts would have known it was illegal. So I do believe it was self-sabotage at the time too, looking back. There's no way my back parts didn't know it was illegal. And so, but anyway, my friend sprung me out of jail, you know, paid the bail. And then I had to report into a parole officer for a year, but he let me do it from out of state after the first month. So we moved out to our land after a month. I got, cause he said, you're not flight risk. You're not this, you know, you're just incredibly stupid. And I said, you're right. So we went up to Arkansas and there was like a little shed there and we poured a cement floor into it, moved in a wood stove. This was in early fall. And we lived there for 3 months and we were building a house because my friend knew how to build too. So we put in a stone foundation for a house. We'd done the beams and we were doing the, and we'd already put in the roofing and stuff. So it was about, and we were starting to, you know, do the walls. And this is about 3 months later. And what we'd done though is we were also going to church because to me, my faith was important. I wanted to have fellowship with Christians. After we'd been there about 2.5 months, though, someone new came to church. And after church, I went, oh crap, that person knows me, to my friend. I'm going to call him T. And he said, oh, you're just paranoid. And I said, I don't think so. He said, why would they be following you now? And I said, because they are. So a week later, we're in our house. We're sleeping in the shed at night because it's fully enclosed. And we start to feel this low, it feels like a low rumble. That's the only way I know how to describe it. And like a small earthquake beneath the ground. It's the weirdest thing. It's almost like if a sonic boom is going overhead, only it's much lower. And this rumbling was going on all the time. You couldn't quite hear it, but it was almost like beneath your human hearing. But it felt like this deep rumble. But I knew suddenly we were getting, it was causing me to wake up at night and have nightmares. And my friend too, he was having the same experience. And then we were going out, it was wintertime and it snowed. And this is in the mountains of Arkansas. And suddenly we're seeing tracks all over our land and they're not ours. It looked like a child's tracks and also an older person's. We called him Bigfoot because he had these huge boots. And so it's real evident that someone's coming onto our land and has been walking all over it. And then we start seeing people in camo walking up and down the hill in front of our property and down on the street below, you know. And I remember saying to my friend, still think I'm paranoid? He said, well, someone's visiting our land. I don't like this. And so our sleep is constantly getting interrupted because that intermittent low rumble is going on. And then it's a few weeks later of seeing constant signs of activity and people walking all sides of our property. And suddenly I hear a really high-pitched ringing in my ears, and my friend does too. And I said, what the crap? And I start to feel sick. I start to feel nauseated. And I said, I think this is some kind of like frequency, high frequency wave. He said, I don't know what that is, but he said, we had old AM, FM radio. So he said, let me try something. He turned it on and he started to turn it to the, like above the normal frequencies. And then you could hear, woo, woo. And then woo, 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 woo. We could hear waveforms on the radio at the high. He said, yeah, you're right. I think it is. So the next day it got louder. And after 3 days, we were both vomiting continuously. And I felt sick. And I felt like every joint in my body was like breaking almost. It was just, I was in such pain and agony. And finally I said, so we had this low frequency thing, which I figured then was probably a low frequency. And then we had the high frequency wave hitting us. And I said, I've got to get some sleep. We got to get off this land. So we did. So we went, got in our truck, left. And the minute we went off of our property line through the gate, it stopped. No rumble, no, our nausea stopped, everything. We spent the night in a hotel and I had the first night's sleep, good night's sleep in 2 weeks. Then every symptom except for some ringing in our ears left. And I said, I think we're getting hit with this stuff. My friend had a cell phone and he had like a little, he had a computer. He had a little thing where he could plug in and get on the internet. It created like a little hotspot. This was several years ago, so you could still do that. And he hit a prepaid card. So he looked up the symptoms of high frequency waves and low. And he found a site in the UK where they use it for crowd control. And it showed every single symptom we've been experiencing. It was just like a checklist. That's. And so then we were praying against it. We went back. The next day we went to our land. The minute we walked back on the land or drove into the land and got out of our truck, it started all over again, only worse. And this time it felt like I was dying and him too. We were like, holy crap. So we went and grabbed all of our stuff, as much of our clothes and stuff. We just grabbed clothes and a couple of personal items. We literally were crawling back to the truck. We could barely move, got off the land, and we were on the run then. And we went then, it was a winter time. We went through Texas. We went through New Mexico. We went through Oklahoma. We were camping in state parks during that time. It was just a very difficult time in my life. Now, years later, I came to know someone from the Jesuit order who had also gotten out. And that's a long story and I won't go into that. And I was talking to her and she said, You two should not have survived that. We had it on kill. And I said, God protected us. We were supposed to have died there. But the grace of God is that he kept us alive. So we spent several months running and waiting for, because, you know, I had a long-term ringing in my ears that took like 2 months to leave, you know, after that experience. And finally, after several months of camping and running and stuff like that, and we came to a small town in North Texas, and my friends, we were out of money, and my friend and I said, I need to get a job. And I said, we have no ID. I said, I cannot show my ID or they will show up again and they will find us. And my friend did not have ID on purpose because he, for the same reason, he had never had one after he left his group. And so he said, well, I'm going to go in and get a job and I won't need ID. And he was a Christian. I said, in this day and age, if you can get a job and you don't need ID, I said, I will believe in miracles because there's no way that you can get a job without ID. Everyone requires it. They won't pay you otherwise. And he said, you watch. He said, I have faith. So we said a prayer. He went in. 15 minutes later, he came back out and he said, I've got a job and I got one for you and they don't need ID. I couldn't believe it.
What?
So we stayed there for 6 months and I was wrapping meat and he was cutting meat and, you know, really, really, really nice people at that place too. I can't speak highly enough of them all. They were wonderful and I enjoyed working with them. And, but then I was also marketing some creative arts that I created. And so I was going to different art fairs, but then one day I went to a high-end furniture store to market one of my creative items. And, you know, I was showing the guy my art and my other items. And then he said, well, I'll think about it. You know, why don't you come back later? And so I told my friend, I said, well, as long as we're here in town, it was a small town in East Texas, or a small city. I said, let's go look at some other places too and market. So we walked around the corner and then suddenly I said, I have a really funny feeling about that guy. I think we should leave immediately. We walk around, back around the corner and there he is by our truck writing down the license plate number. He sees us and he rushes into the shop. And by then, and so what happened then is the cult showed up again, of course. Within 2 days, they were coming by and harassing us. So my friend and I went and we went around 10 states in 10 months. We took all the money we'd saved during our time at the meat plant and packing plant and just went. We went to Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, Georgia, Florida, Alabama, Louisiana, and we lived in we bought a cargo van. We traded my truck to a friend for a cargo van. We were living in that. And then after a while, we got tired of running around. So we got a job at a horse farm then, and we lived there for a year. And that was good until, again, I was going to church and someone saw me. And within a few days there, they were again. We saw footprints all through the muck in the horse pen, and we had not been walking there. And so we said, oh, dear Lord, they found us. And then my friend said, well, let's try to stay here. We were living in a mobile home there on the ranch. We were exercising the horses and taking care of them. And let's see if maybe they'll leave us alone. You know, maybe they're just checking things out. And I said, all right. The next night, I felt a low rumble in the ground. And my friend and I started having nightmares and waking up every 2 hours. And that rumble was just continuous. And I went, oh, crap, here it comes again. And so I said, we're going to have to leave because they're doing it again. And so we did. And he said, well, then we'll have to get our truck ready again because to help our anonymity, the guy we were working for, let's drive his truck. And that's the one whose license plate they'd written down. So we took our truck out from undercover, the covers, and he said, I have to fix a few things. Well, that day, the high-pitched noise started again. And we started to feel sick again. And so he's racing to get the truck fixed. He does, you know, and I think it needed a spark plug and it needed something else. And so he fixes it as quickly as he can, does the oil change and stuff and gets it ready. And by then we're just vomiting again and stuff like that, but we leave the property and it stops, of course. Well, so then we went down, we traveled around various cities in Central Texas, ended up living in a garage, ended up working for $50 a week for someone who had a small store next to his service garage, and he let us sleep in the garage at night. And then my friend got a job. T got a job in a restaurant there. And I was at home I was writing because I was a writer. And so I was trying to get work like that. And people show up at the house and they hurt me very badly there. And I told my friend, and then I went and so I started staying at the restaurant and I just grabbed a table where he worked so that I'd be around people writing. And I don't know it. And after a few months there, you know, I said, you know, I'm tired of living like this, but we have to. So we rented a little house in next to the restaurant. And 2 days later, we were asleep in the middle of the night. And all of a sudden it felt like I was dying. My friend too. I mean, I felt like I was being zapped with a stun gun, and he did too. And we literally again, I mean, I felt like I was dying. I said, we got to get out of here. We went out to the truck and left. And again, the friend of mine that had left the order said, you were supposed to die there. And I said, I know. I said, but I was screaming, Jesus, Jesus, help me, help us. And we made it to the truck and we escaped again. So we wander around camping at state parks for a few more months, run out of money, realize we have to be able to work to have some money to live on. And so we end up in a small town in West Texas. And I said, I can't run anymore. I said, even if they kill me. But at this point, I said, God, just protect me because I need your protection. I can't keep going through this. It's horrible. And so we did. And so we went to work at a meat plant there. And they hired me to rep meat. And we went to a small church there. And we were there for about a year and a half. But while I was there, they had hired a young man who I instantly recognized. And he was in his 20s, and I believed he was one of my nephews from overseas in Italy. And I went to tea and I said, I know this kid and I'm related to him, and he's here to try to take me back to Rome. And my friend said, looks right at me, says, and who the hell were you that they're after you after this many years? And he looked at me, he said, have you told me the truth about who you were? I said, yeah, as far as I knew. I had told him everything. I said, these are very persistent people. And I said, you have to realize when I left, I was fourth general in the Jesuit army. I told him that before. And he said, well, they sure are persistent. I said, yeah, because it makes them look bad when one of their leaders leaves. Well, he didn't believe me, though. He said, I don't believe that. Well, until a couple of days later, we're at work, and at work, everybody can play like songs that they enjoy. You know, like some of the guys liked rap, and some of them liked rock and roll, and some like jazz, and I like Christian. So we would each be given a half hour a day. Well, this kid, when it's his turn, He puts on Ave Maria at full blast in Latin. Now, you realize that's one of the most triggering songs for my system that a person could play. And there's, I won't go into the reasons why, but it's a call back. Okay. And I'm shaking, trying to wrap me while this song is playing. And later I said, why would a 21-year-old kid enjoy, want to play Ave Maria over and over? He said, oh, because it calms me down when I'm anxious. It's my favorite song. And so that night on the way home, I tell T, now, do you believe me that something's a little odd about this kid? And he says, no. I said, well, how about the fact that while you and the other guys are out smoking, he's sitting with a 56-year-old woman for lunch talking the whole time. Don't you find that odd? Wouldn't a 21-year-old want to be with younger people? Nah. He says, it bothers you come out and eat with us. So I did. Even though it was cold that winter, I went out and ate with the guys. And they all smoked, and I hate smoke, but, you know, I just sat with them rather than be alone with them. Well, then 2 weeks later, we're going to cash a paycheck. And the kid asked, the 21-year-old asked for a ride to cash his paycheck. And the whole way there, he starts saying, you know what? I have this weird form of schizophrenia where I've been told I have different personalities, and the different personalities come out and do things that I'm not aware of, you know, and some of them speak different languages and stuff. So he's just babbling on about this. And he said, what do you think I should do? And he's looking at me.
Like, wow, I could tell you that.
Hey, you have to know that no one at work knows anything about, I've never told anyone at work anything about myself. Not one thing. None of them know my past. And so after he cashes his paycheck, I just said, well, I think I would go see a therapist if I were you. And so on the way home, then after we drop him off, I turn to T and I say, now, do you believe me? He said, well, that was weird. Yeah. Well, anyway, well, the long and the short of it is that a few months later, T decided he'd had enough. He was tired of being chased. He was tired of being with me. He said, you have to find somewhere else to live. I'm going to go live on my mother's land, and you can't come. So he said, even though we had like a common law marriage, even though we'd stopped having relations years before. So he said, I can't take the constant harassment anymore. It's too much for me. He said, I didn't sign up for this. And I said, but I told you when we left our friend's house that I had years to go in my healing. And he said, well, I didn't believe you. I thought it would just be a couple months. He said, I had no idea of how much blank you had inside to work through still. I thought you were almost done. And I said, I never told you that. I made it real clear that I was still had many years ago. He said, well, I didn't realize that. So he gave me 3 weeks to find a place to live. And I did. I contacted a bunch of Christian ministries, and then I found a Christian prayer minister, and I went to live to be near that person. And that person was very helpful to me too for several years in my journey. And I continued working on my stuff, but it was hard because at that point I felt very alone and I felt very betrayed too. Here I'd made a friends with someone who was, he was integrated, but he was not healed. And I realize that now, emotionally healed. And I felt completely emotionally abandoned at a critical time in my healing. And it was so hard, but I did do my best. I made a stand. Then I decided I don't want to go back. And I would cry out to God and say, help me, God. And help me through this. And I had just a little bit of money to live on left over from the inheritance, you know, because I had to contact the executor and she gave me the money. And I knew the cult knew where I was, and there were constant attempts to get a hold of me during that time. But my parts were sick of it, and they decided to say no, no more. And it helped that one night I was really having a very difficult time, and I had a dream. And in my dream, Jesus said, I love you. I'm going to help you. I'm going to help you make a stand. And he has. He really has. I kept journaling. I kept processing my feelings. I kept doing collages and survivor art. And I believe that God very much consistently has heard my prayers. There's another story. When I was staying at my friend's house, by the way, I don't know if I said this in the last interview or not, but like the friend in Texas for 2 years, I had a dream where the 12 members of the Secret Vatican Council said, "We're going to come and kill you and your friends, just so you know. You might as well warn them so they can get out of the house." Well, I did. I told them the next morning. I said, "They're going to come and kill you guys and me." And the one friend, T, he got a shotgun, put it next to the door and said, "Well, if they come, I'll put up a fight." And I said, "You don't know. That's like using a water pistol against a Uzi. These teams come in, they're serious. You do know that." I said, "I think we do better to fast and pray." And we did. We fast and prayed for 2 days. And then the date that they'd given me passed. And then later, you know, my friends were scratching their heads and said, "Well, maybe they were just messing with your head." And I said, "Maybe so." Well, I found out from the friend of mine that left the order that I told you about. And this person told me, "We sent a team that day to kill you all. And the team came back and reported me." You know what they said? They said that they couldn't find the house. And this person said, "I said, what do you mean you can't find the house? You've been going past it for weeks." And they said, "Yeah, but it disappeared." They said every other house was on the street, but that house did not exist when we went. And I looked at this individual. I said, "And so how did you guys explain this?" And this person said, "Well, we realize sometimes there's things that you can't explain. And we just chalked it up to that." So anyway. So the past few years, I've been in prayer. I've been in ministry with two different prayer ministers at times. And I've had accountability from non-dissociative friends, too, that I live with. And so that there's a lot of accountability in my life still. I have worked with my core. I've worked with all the top controllers in my system. I've been undoing my shell programming. I've been undoing, I remember my presentations. And so God has been faithful because I've been crying out to him for safety and help for 35 years during my journey. And I've actually had very little safety as my story tells, but I've always said, "To the true God, help me. Help me to find safety. Help me to get free." And he has consistently, and even in small ways like that, or in big ways like that miracle, getting a job without needing ID, or not letting them kill me when they had put the setting to kill on the high frequency waves. He has consistently hidden me, I believe, in the cleft of his hand. God has been faithful when I couldn't be, when I was too tired, exhausted, hurt, angry, miserable, and saying, "Why do they keep getting to chase me, God, if I'm asking for your protection?" And he's saying, "I love you." And the hardest thing is there still attempts to trigger me. Like I'll go out into public and because I'm not trying to hide anymore. And I've been, I'll go to a public place. Like a store, and they'll send someone I know from my past who's signing "save me," meaning, you know, "Tonight we're going to hurt you" or something. And I've cried my heart out over things like that. And I was praying one night before I went to sleep. And I was asking Jesus, "What do I do? What do I do?" Because I don't want them to get hurt because I'm saying no to going back. And that night, I had a dream, and Jesus showed me, I'm in the cleft of this huge cliff. It's like way off the ground. And there's a whirlwind and a sandstorm. It's this huge sandstorm right outside the cleft. And Jesus is right next to me. And in the sandstorm, I see someone that I love, and they're crying. They're saying, save me, save me. And I can see all the people I love, they're still in the group. And they're saying, save me, rescue me, only you can do this. And I look at Jesus, and he looks right at me. He says, do not go out into the storm. I said, but Lord, you can hear them crying for help. He said, let me do it. And he says, because I start to stick my hand out, and the sand is like literally like shredding my fingers. I pull it back in. And he said, let me do it. So he walks out. As he's walking out into the storm, he's holding the people, talking to them, but he's also his angels, and they're ministering to them. And then later he comes back to me. He says, you were not designed to go into that storm. I can. I rise, and then he said, follow me. And we go deeper into that cleft in the rock, and it opens up, and there's the most beautiful, brilliant light. And I realize that I'm seeing a glimpse of heaven as I'm walking with him further in. He says, you do this, and I'll take care of the other. And then the dream ended. And I realized he was showing me that I'm not equipped to rest. I can't save my loved ones. If they come up to me in a public place, and they have, or at a church, or sit behind me and say, or if I see a subliminal online of loved ones being hurt, saying, please, I need you to rescue me. You've got to come back or else. Jesus was telling me, that's not your job. That's my job. And so I cannot save them by giving in to their request to go with them. Some, like I've been in public, and someone's going to say, just 5 minute cup of coffee. But the problem with that is a cup of coffee leads to other things. I can't even say yes to that with someone from my past. But what he is saying is, if I pray for them and I trust Jesus to take care of them, he will. He can reach them in a way I can't. And I can encourage them also by telling my story, that it is possible to really get free. I can encourage them too by my witness, because every time I say no to someone that comes up to me and says, please, please come with me, or they'll bring my twins and they'll say, just switch out with your twin and come with me for a while. And I have to say no. And then they say, you don't love me anymore. And what they don't realize is, I love you enough that I have to tell you no. I have to show you that not everyone is going to be bullied by fear. That not everyone is a slave to Satan and his threats. And my witness by saying no is a greater witness than if I ever went with someone. Because in my past, I did go with people for a cup of coffee and things years ago, and it never turned out well. And so the witness I have is, I love the people from my past enough that I will say no when they're doing their job, which is to get me to go with them. And it's not lack of love. And they say, oh, you have a cold heart, or, you know, and all that. And it's not that. It is my desire to show them there's a way out. And I don't want to be bullied anymore by fear. And that's why I'm doing these interviews. And that's why I've done my writing, because it was a long journey, as you can tell, for me to get free. It was a long journey for me to finally realize that God could protect me. It was a long journey. I had 2 years in Texas, and I've had 4 years here of relative safety. But a lot of my life, I was on the run, as you can hear. But God knew my heart was to get free, and that's why I did those things. I was willing to do whatever it took to get away, to get free. I know my children in various presentations probably feel that I abandoned them. They were all adults. They were all, like, you know, in their 20s and late teens when I tried to leave the first time. It's not lack of love. I did not want them to grow up thinking everyone is a slave to this group. I've realized now that all my life I was bullied by Satan. And every member of the order was bullied by him. We were terrified of him. In fact, one of the worst programs I had to undo was the fear of disobedience, the fear, and it's called the wrath of Satan. I had to work through that program. I had to work through the terror I felt at the idea of disobeying my programming commands. But it's because I let Satan bully me into thinking he had all this power over me and my loved ones, because that's what I was taught when I was little. I had to work through the rage. These people taught me a bunch of bullcrap. Excuse my language, but that's what it was. I believed a lie. And it's time. I believe the truth now, that God is able to protect me, that his son Jesus is able to protect me, and that I have the authority over anything that tries to come against me. Because I believe that the real Jesus of the Bible, and I'm defining that because I had a lot of anti-Christian programming to believe in a false Jesus that was powerless. But the real Jesus of the Bible does protect. And he heard my cry for hope and help and safety over the years. And even when I was not faithful to him, he was faithful to me. And I can't take credit for my healing. I'm going to give him the credit because I did my part. I did everything I could to stay free. But he did his part too. He's been there with me, even when I didn't know it. And I've had plenty of chances to witness over the last few years to people there in the group that have been, come up to say, please come with me, you know, just for a few minutes. I'll say, I can't. But I said, I want you to know Jesus loves you so much. He knows exactly what you've been doing. And he still loves you. Turn to him. I get to do that pretty often, and it's pretty cool. So that's my testimony. This is a testimony I cannot give at church. No one in my daily life knows my past because I think it would weak people out. I don't think most people in most small towns or churches are ready to hear, or at least in my experience. And there may be fortunate survivors whose churches are able to hear their story. But in every church I've ever been where I disclosed I was a survivor of this, I got instantly shunned. And so what I've chosen to do in the last 10 years is to not disclose my past to the people that I go to church with or that I work with or anything else. And I found they treat me a lot nicer. They don't run when they see me coming or act like I'm this weird unicorn, you know, or something like that. I used to joke that people act like I've got like demon cooties and they're going to jump onto them, you know, if they talk to me. You know, I literally had one pastor that didn't know my past and he just was so nice and we got along so well. I did so well at his church. And then my friend in Texas told him my past and he never came up to me again, never talked to me again after that. And he always looked like a deer in the headlights when I came to ask him a question, you know, about like how to do something, you know, like I was cleaning the church. What do I do with this? He always looked a little terrified of me after that. And I thought, I wish you hadn't told him that, you know. And I went to her that night and I said, did you tell him? And she said, well, yeah. I said, yeah, I could tell, you know. So people can't always handle truth, but God can. And Jesus can handle my story. He can hear it. And that's the main thing. And he's called a few very rare people to be able to hear it too. And for that, I'm very grateful. And I'm grateful, Emma, that you can hear these stories too and share them. That's a blessing.
It's an honor to hear these stories. That's how I look at it. You shouldn't be here. And if you are here, you shouldn't be out of the cult. You know, the measures, like how your story tells, the measures that are put in place to keep you enslaved are so beyond what people can even imagine, whether it's electronic mind control and warfare that you can't see. You know, you're being attacked in your own home by frequencies. There's not even a person you can, you know, go after. It's something totally invisible except how your body reacts to it. You know, the handlers, yeah, the people that come in your life. And the worst part, like you said, is that in the spaces that are supposed to be the salvation for people to go when they're in need, whether it's a church, whether it's a therapist's office, even friends. Society turns away from this. The people that should be looking it in the eye and offering help in places and safe places to disclose or to be, you know, it's so rare to find that.
Yeah.
And it's awful. You know, it breaks my heart so much to see the courage, especially that it takes to finally tell somebody this stuff. You know, you spend your whole life not being able to talk about stuff, having to be quiet. And then you get hit with all these memories and want to share what you went through and heal. And not only do people not want to hear it, but then how you've had in your life, people turn away. Oh, it's too much. I didn't realize it was going to be this. I didn't realize it was going to be that, or I don't want to, you know, and it is, it's really sad, you know, and I appreciate you still having the courage to speak out and still going and sharing and not shutting down because of that, because there are people out there that care. There are people that have been listening to you, even if you couldn't see them on the other side of the screen, people mm-hmm. that you have helped, lives that you've changed, therapists that might be, you know, helping people now because they have the tools that you've given them. So I thank you too, Svali, for continuing to go on, because I didn't go through what you did. And when I try to put myself in your shoes, it's so impossible for me, but I have no idea what I would do in those circumstances. You know, it makes me like want to shut down even thinking about going through all that, you know, and just being turned away. So you're really brave and courageous for continuing to go on. And I want you to know that your work and your voice does help people.
Well, but think of the alternative. If I hadn't tried to break free, I would still be part of an organization that hurts little children, that is engaged in trafficking, that bullies fetuses into believing lies. Because the only people I think that really believe Satan is so powerful, they have to take babies and teach them that lie. And or organization where no one's free to really love each other. Everyone's so freaking scared of disobedience that you can't go with your brother or sister and just be you. And take a week off and just say and talk about, everyone has to be so careful around each other in those groups. Oh, we can't talk about, oh, better not do that, or also report on me. Even your brother will do that, or your sister. So the alternative to not breaking free was to just stay in that lie. And I couldn't stand it. I didn't want my children and grandchildren to grow up thinking no one ever gets free. But what helped me too is I've known other members of the Jesuit order that have gotten free over the years, really free. I can think of two people I knew, one partly because of my testimony to him when I was younger, decided to leave. He was first general in the Jesuit order and he got out. His name was Simone. And he actually left. And I'm going to share just a couple of brief glimpses of some of the neat things I've seen. And 10 years after Simone left, he was fully healed. He completely integrated. And then he came back to the Vatican and he preached to us. He walked right through our security systems. They couldn't be, I think he had an angel with, I can't explain it because we're all like, how did that happen? Because they have special biometric security in the levels beneath the Vatican and other places. He walks right in and he starts holding the babies and praying for them. And then he starts preaching but not preaching. He's giving words of knowledge. He's telling us, I know you think this, but this is what God thinks about that. Or you're going to do this, but you know what? There's a better way. So he was being very specific in the words he gave to us. And and some of the people left with him. Now, I left a few weeks later. There's another woman who got out, walked away with them, and then eventually got completely free and completely healed. And she also is out. Now, I don't know where they live right now because I haven't stayed in contact with them. But I do know that she has also gone and done the same thing as Simone and talked to people in the Vatican. And I believe that God is going to send more and more people. So people who say, well, if you're in the depths of darkness in the levels beneath the Vatican, God can't go there. Well, no, yes, he can. And he does. and he has been. He has brought witnesses of his love over and over to people in this group too.
That's amazing. And that is something that your story goes back to, is that power of love and how it can defeat decades and decades and decades of fear and evil. And love always overcomes. God always overcomes. There's nothing too big. It's never too late. There's never a wrong time or a inconvenient time for him. He will always show up and help with open arms, with no agenda, with no ulterior motives, just unconditional love. Yeah. And I love that you're able to take that now and be an example of it. You know, how you were saying that you had to help yourself. It's just like how whenever you fly, they say, put your oxygen mask on before helping other people. You know, sometimes we have to do that and be selfish and put that mask on and save ourselves. And then, you know, set that example and say, okay, and now it's your turn. But not everybody's ready for that, like you said, and it doesn't serve you to go back to that. The example that you're setting for your children, they're so lucky to have that, because look at all those generations before you and after you that people didn't leave. And if they did, it was just a couple people out of this massive organization that you grew up in, you know, this group. And so I think it's amazing. And you are such a testament to everything that you've learned. You exemplify that now. And it's really inspiring to see what's on the other side of this journey.
Okay. Well, Emma, thank you. And I appreciate the contribution to the every other survivor who's shared their story or has broken free gives to. I think it's going to give people a better understanding, like you said, of what goes on and what survivors struggle with at times when they're trying to break free. And my prayer is that maybe there would be more resources. I don't think it's good to put survivors together, like in a shelter of any kind, because I think that's a setup for trouble. But even if families within a church who are not dissociative felt led to help survivors, because I got my main help from people who let me live with them who are not dissociative for a period of time. And it was weird because at first, you know, my cult parts are all like, this is weird. There's no rituals. There's no this. There's no sex. There's no blah, 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 you know. And they really freaked out for a while until they realized, hey, and they kept waiting for it to happen for the first few months, to be honest. And then when it doesn't happen, they're like, huh. And that, it really made them question, too, what they've been told all their lives.
Well, maybe if you want, I think that this would be really helpful information if you wanted to do an episode on maybe some solutions, and we could talk about the struggles that you went through finding help and, you know, what could have been really helpful for you, and maybe give people some ideas on how they can take action in their own communities, things that maybe they could strive to talk about with pastors at their church to see if that's a conversation that they could have. And I think that might be a good topic to talk about more of, and even how, you know, you got through your healing, like some things that worked for you, some things that didn't, what you've learned. So if you wanted to, I think that would be a really cool episode to do too.
It'd be interesting. As you can tell though, I may not be the person to ask about how to talk to your pastor, because like I said, I didn't have real good luck with that, but maybe I could suggest some ideas on thoughts for pastors if someone tells them reveals a little bit. And by the way, I'm not talking about you go to church and your first week there, you disclose your past. By the way, this is after a relationship of a year or so. Well, anyway, I'll talk about that more. But anyway, you know, even doing that, even I need to think about that too, because I have thoughts on what I wish pastors would do, you know.
And even friends, like how can somebody be a good helper? Like you name times that people weren't, you know, and they sort of abandon you. And maybe we could talk too about really positive experiences you had and people that did things right. And that could apply to a pastor, a therapist, a friend. You know, there's a lot to learn too on just how to hold space for somebody going through stuff and sort of how to be a good helper on the other side.
Okay. Yeah. I certainly think that's needed, and I think it's a great topic. And I'd also love to hear what other survivors have to say on that too, because I'm sure there's others that might have ideas too that I wouldn't even think of, you know?
Absolutely. It's a topic I think we can all come together and, you know, create in our world, you know, by putting our minds together and just saying, what if, you know, what if we did this, or what if this existed? And maybe it'll help spawn some ideas for projects that people can start doing in their own communities.
Yeah. I think that'd be good, because certainly there's increasing support for trafficking survivors. And I just, in a way, you can think of ritual abuse as cult trafficking, lifetime trafficking, you know, in one broad sense. I know it covers a lot more than that. I do get that. And, but, you know, I sometimes I scratch my head. It's like, we're willing to help trafficking survivors, and yet so many cult survivors have been horribly trafficked for extensive periods too. And where's the empathy for this? Amen. I don't mean to sound bitter when I say that. I have to ask the question, where's the empathy that we have for trafficking survivors? Except some trafficking survivors can point to the pimp on the corner and say, there he is. And you can see the other girls. Whereas a lot of times with cult abuse, you don't have that. You can't point to that person, because even if they're the person that abused you, they're going to lie. They're going to be dissociative and say, oh, she or he's nuts. This never happened. I can tell you right now, if someone were to contact, say, any of my families in my different presentations and say, is this true? Were you really in a cult? Of course they're going to say no, or she's crazy or whatever, because they have programming to not validate a survivor's memories. So I can't point to someone and say, well, they were part of my abuse, because you know what they're going to do? No, I wasn't. You know, she's making it up. And then it's your word against theirs. And that's, I think, part of what makes it harder for people to rally around cult survivors. We can't point to our perpetrators often, because our perpetrators will lie about it. We don't have videos of them. And God bless anyone if they ever do get one, but of them abusing us. You know, we don't have normally, now there are situations where I think this has happened, but not in my experience, where 10 people say, oh yeah, that same person abused me. That's him. And often if these cases go to court, because people do say, well, this person abused me, we have a court system that's corrupt, where judges are bribed, where threats are made, where evidence disappears. You know, so even if you do have a legitimate finger pointing, so often the evidence just disappears. People go and break into safes. I will give you an example from my own life. Well, first, I made a 2-hour videotape testimony of how the cult operated in San Diego with lawyers from 2 teams. And I did it because there was a therapist who helped survivors in San Diego, and she was being sued. And so I gave my testimony to help her and the other therapists. Okay. And as I'm giving my, I'll give 2 examples. As I'm giving my testimony, the lawyers who were promoting the cult side said, did you love your mother? Right in the middle of my telling them how the cult works. I go, what? Do you love your mother? I said, what's that have to do with my testimony? Because I'm going to send her this video. Do you love her? And of course, the other said, oh, he's trying to intimidate the witness. I said, I don't care if you send it to, and I named leadership in San Diego. I don't care if you send it to everyone. I already know they're going to see it. But that doesn't make what you're trying to do and your intimidation here right. That's one example. Now, imagine if I hadn't stood up to the man and said, yeah, let's delete the video. That's just one example of it. And there was, I'm trying to think of the other time now. There was another time, and this was when I went to Texas, but before I went to my friend's house, but I was working on healing, and I got an email from a man on the East Coast. And he said, my wife passed away. And after she passed away, I went into the back of her of one of her closets. I was cleaning her stuff out. She passed away 3 years ago. And he said, I found these locked steel boxes full of files. And he said, I got them opened. And he said, and the files had the name of, and he said my legal name, my full name. And he said, there were photographs of you, and he said, are you so-and-so? And do you work here? Blah, blah, blah. And blah, blah, blah. And I said, yes, yes, yes. Why are you asking me? And he said, because I have photographs and things I'd like to send you. And I said, okay. I said, can you fax me some? I'd like to see this as soon as possible. And he faxed me pictures of me as a 2 and 3 year old, a 3 year old little girl. I'm with a woman I've never seen before in my life. And then there's a chart with my legal name on it. And it's a chart of like IV medications being given. And I'm like 3.5 years old. And then there's all kinds of letters back and forth from San Diego and the East Coast during the year that I left the group when I was an adult, saying, what do we do about her? Blah, blah, blah. And the initials were the leader in San Diego who I worked under. And it was to the East Coast Council. And so I took it to my therapist and I said, I want you to keep this. This is pre-validating. I'm not nuts and making all this up. 2 days later, I get an email from the same man. He said, who the hell are you? He said, I was at work today. When I came back. My house was trashed. They went through all those papers are gone that I was going to send you. He said, they destroyed my home office. He said, never contact me again, please.
Oh my gosh.
Well, they don't like evidence laying around. Mm-hmm.
That's the part that's really hard for society to understand. Everybody wants evidence. And it's like, you really think somebody who spends a whole lifetime being sophisticated and abusing people is just going to hand evidence over and be like, here you go, go on your way, you're free.
Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't happen that way.
Yeah.
And maybe we could talk about that too next time, some of that aspect of it, you know, the stuff that you deal with whenever you're leaving and trying to heal, stuff like that.
Yeah.
I want to be respectful of your time, Svali. I really appreciate you sharing. And do you want to remind people real quick where they can find your blog and your book?
Okay. It's SvaliSpeaksAgain .wordpress.com. So it's my name and speaks again, all one word, .wordpress.com. Okay. And you can also find my book on Amazon, I believe, and Kindle. And so that's where you can find it.
Perfect. I'll have all that linked, as well as there was another book she recommended, Finding Freedom, as well as
Yes.
Prayer Warriors and Prayer Warriors 2, which are great resources for you guys. So I'll have all that linked below. Let me get
Thank you. Here. Yeah.
I'll have your blog linked, everything else. Svali, I really appreciate you. You're such a ray of light. You have helped so many people and continue to. I think your journey is just beginning, even though it probably feels like you've been in the muck for, you know, a long time, which you have. But I think your impact is just beginning. And I think that's beautiful. So I really appreciate you sharing on here. I appreciate you guys listening. I will have all my links, all Svali's links below. Please go support and connect with her. We need more people that are sharing this type of content and consuming it. It's not always easy to read, but we do need to learn about this as society. Svali does a wonderful job breaking down everything from childhood all the way to adulthood on what to know about programming from a therapist perspective, sort of what we need therapists to know, as well as if you're a helper or a survivor. So please go support her, you guys. Support me. Have all my links below, like I said. I appreciate you guys so much. God bless you, and we'll see you next time.